Okay, we'll continue our introduction to the Bible. Let's talk about the specific contents of the Bible as it has been arranged in our English Bibles. Basically, it's the same as in most Bibles around the world. The Protestant Bible, essentially, we're talking about. It's kind of interesting how it's arranged, but you need to realize that some of the things we're going to observe, they're really, like the number of books in each category would be different in the Jewish Bible if you go back far enough. Because Samuel, we have two books of Samuel, 1st and 2nd Samuel. They were originally one book. We have two books of Kings, 1st and 2nd Kings. They were originally one book. And we have two books of Chronicles, which were originally one book. They were divided in each case into two, probably for practical reasons, because the size of the scroll that it would take to for such a large book was probably unwieldy. I think that's the best theory of why they were divided into two. So you've got 1st and 2nd Samuel is really one book divided into two scrolls, and same with Kings and Chronicles. Having said that, the books have come down to us in the numbers that we have now, and there are 39 books in our Old Testament, and 27 in the New Testament. Now here's how they divide up. And it's kind of interesting because it's rather, in the case of the Old Testament, rather it almost looks deliberate. It almost looks like God arranged it because it doesn't seem like man could. But there's 17 historical books, or books that are historical in nature, at the beginning of our Old Testament. That's including, of course, the Torah, the five books of Moses, but also there's another 12. And those 12 would be from Joshua through Esther. Now remember, the Jewish Bible is arranged differently, so we're just talking about the way that it's arranged in our Bibles. But you've got these 17 historical books. Now in this case, there are five which are major books. The Torah has always been recognized as the core of the Old Testament revelation. And that begins with Genesis, which tells the history of the world and all of that, up until the Jews went into Egypt. But then Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy are essentially the lifetime of Moses and the history of that period. So you've got five major history books, and then you've got 12 that are, we could say, minor history books. And of those 12 minor ones, 9 of them deal with the period before the Jewish exile to Babylon. The Jews in their history spent 2 seasons as captives in foreign countries. One was, of course, the years they spent in Egypt before the time of the Exodus, and one is the time they spent in Babylon, a much shorter time, only about 70 years. But those were important, you know, punctuators in the history of the people of Israel. Now, of the 12 minor historical books in the Old Testament, 9 of them are before the exile, and 3 of them deal with the period after the exile. The reason that's interesting is because if you look at the prophetic books, which is the last 17 books of our Old Testament arrangement, there are 5 major books there too, and 12 minor ones. And among the minor ones, there are 9 that deal with prior to the exile and 3 after the exile. So there's kind of a symmetry between the historical collection and the prophetic collection. Of the major prophets, the ones that we regard as the major prophets are Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, and Daniel. That's the arrangements in our Bibles. Lamentations, I suppose, hardly deserves to be called a major prophet. It's only a few chapters long, but it is included with them because it is the work of Jeremiah, and he's a major prophet. So we have 5 major historical books in the Pentateuch, or the Torah, and we have 5 major prophets. We also have 12 lesser historical books and 12 lesser or minor prophets. And of those 12, 9 of the lesser historical books deal with the period before the Babylonian exile. And 9 of the minor prophets also deal with the period before the Babylonian exile. We call it pre-exilic. And 3 of the historical books and 3 of the prophetic books, the last 3 in the arrangement in each case, are post-exilic. Now, in between those two collections, there are 5 books that are poetry books. Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. Of those, the latter 3 are written by Solomon. Job, we don't know who the author was, but the man Job apparently lived even before the time of Moses. Therefore, Job apparently lived between the time that Genesis closes and the time that Exodus opens. He appears to live in the patriarchal period, as we call it, the time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their offspring, but especially in the later part. And the reason for saying that is that Job, some of his friends have names that are associated with the family of Esau, who is Jacob's brother. So it would appear that Job lived after the time of Esau, but before the time of Moses, and therefore in between Genesis and Exodus is Job. But the reason Job is included as a poetry book rather than a historical book is there's really only 2.5 chapters in Job out of 42 that are historical in nature. The first 2 chapters of Job tell the story of Job, and the last few verses in the last chapter tell the closing of the story. But the middle 40 chapters of Job are all poetic. They are simply dialogues between Job and his friends, and they are written in poetry. They're philosophical dialogues in poetry. The book of Psalms is, poetry, mostly written by David, as near as we can tell. The Psalms, some of them are anonymous, some of them have the author's names on them. There's 150 Psalms, exactly half of them, 75 of them, have David's name on them. Of those that don't have David's name, a few of them have other people's names, but quite a few of the Psalms are anonymous. And there's a good reason to believe that some of them are from David, even if they don't have his name on them. So David probably wrote the majority of the Psalms. So the 5 poetic books, the Solomon wrote Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. It would appear that Proverbs was written before Solomon backslid. Ecclesiastes appears to be written when Solomon was an old man, when he had returned to the Lord after backsliding. And Song of Solomon is a love song that Solomon wrote to one of his many wives, apparently his favorite. So that's what the Old Testament is comprised of. You've got 17 historical books, 17 prophetic books, and in between you've got 5 poetic books. Now the New Testament has 5 historical books also, as the Old Testament has the Pentateuch as its major historical books. The New Testament has 4 Gospels and the Book of Acts as the historical section. Then you have 13 epistles that are written by Paul. 9 of them are written to churches, and 4 of them are written to individuals, which would be Philemon and Titus and 2 letters to Timothy. Those are written to individuals, whereas the others are all written to congregations. There are 8 books that are non-Pauline epistles. Those are written, sometimes they're called general epistles. They're not mostly addressed to any one church. James is the first of those. He writes to the 12 tribes that are scattered abroad, apparently Christian Jews throughout the Roman Empire. Peter writes to the churches of Asia and Bithynia and several other places, Cappadocia, Galatia, a wide range of churches, most of which had been evangelized by Paul. And many scholars think that Peter wrote after Paul died, and so he kind of followed up on Paul's churches, writing to them. 2 Peter appears to be written to the same churches. The books of John, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, are epistles by John to an undisclosed set of recipients, except that 2nd John is written to a woman or a church who could metaphorically be referred to as a woman. No one knows for sure. And 3 John is written to a man named Gaius, who is a friend of John's, apparently. But 1 John is written to undisclosed recipients. We don't know who 1 John was written to. Then you've got Jude. And so those 8 books comprise what are called the general epistles. Some call them Catholic epistles, because Catholic means universal. And some call them Jewish epistles, suggesting that these are written primarily to Jewish Christians. That is certainly true of the book of James. It is not evident of the other books, so I'm reluctant to refer to them as Jewish epistles. Then, of course, you've got one prophetic book in the New Testament. That's the book of Revelation. It's the only book of prophecy in the New Testament. And as I said, it was included not because it's prophecy, but because it's apostolic, because John, the author, is an apostle. Now, I want to give you a quick survey of the historical period covered in the Bible. This is primarily the historical period covered in the Old Testament, because that's where most of the history took place. Old Testament history appears to be almost exactly 4,000 years long. By some estimates, Jesus was born in the year 4 BC. Now, I know that seems strange to say that, because we think of BC meaning before Christ. And yet, if Jesus was born in 4 BC, then the year 1 and 2 BC would be after Christ was born. But the reason for that confusion is that the original time in history after Christ, in Christian times, I'm not sure when it began to be so. I would assume it was probably in Constantine's time or later. Someone began to chart the years from the birth of Christ. How'd they do it before that? Well, you can tell by reading the Old Testament how they did that. They counted the years from the beginning of the reign of certain kings. The first year of Nebuchadnezzar. The 3rd year of Jehoiakim. You know, the king of Judah. Historical records were dated by how long a certain king had been reigning. Now, once the Roman Empire became Christian, and of course, it became official that Jesus was the king. He was recognized throughout the Roman Empire as the king. And so Europe began to refer to the year of our king, or the year of our Lord. Anno Domini, A.D. Anno Domini means the year of our Lord. So instead of the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, you had the first year of King Jesus, 1 A.D. However, once they set the time, the estimated time of Jesus' birth, and began numbering from it backward and forward before Christ and Anno Domini, they had miscalculated. They miscalculated the year of Jesus' birth. And only much later did archaeological finds discover that Jesus was not born at the time they thought, but some years earlier. The reason for that is that Herod, who you know was alive when Jesus was born, he's the one who ordered the death of the infants in Bethlehem when Jesus was a baby. Herod died in the year 4 BC. We know that now from historical records. So the year that had been called 4 BC, actually Jesus was already born before that. He could have been born as early as 6 BC, but 4 BC is a good case can be made for him being born the same year Herod died. In any case, Jesus died, let's just say Jesus died by some estimates in 4 BC. If you use the genealogies given in the book of Genesis and other historical information known from both the Bible and from outside, it would appear that the creation of Adam and Eve took place in the year 4004 BC. Exactly 4,000 years before Jesus was born. Now, there are many scholars who believe that the genealogies are not to be the sole means of counting, you know, the years back to the creation. And many people feel that the genealogies are not comprehensive. That can be argued both ways. But the point is, if you use the genealogies as exact, and they certainly sound like they're exact. They speak as if they're given the exact years that someone became the father of someone else and so forth. And you do the math, you have really the creation of Adam and Eve in the year 4004 BC. And Jesus born perhaps 4 BC, or give or take, a year or two. Well, not give or take, but take. So that means the entire Old Testament history is almost exactly 4,000 years, if not exactly 4,000 years, from Adam to Christ. Now, that's a nice round number, but it's even interesting how the key, some of the key figures punctuate it nicely. For example, all of Old Testament history divides into what we could call pre-Abrahamic and post-Abrahamic history. Abraham is the dividing point. Why? Because God made a covenant with this man Abraham, which has been unfolding ever since. The covenant God made with Abraham was that through his seed, all the nations of the world would be blessed. That began to unfold with the development of Abraham's family through Isaac and Jacob and the 12 sons of Jacob, eventually the 12 tribes of Israel, the nation of Israel. Then Christ, who is Abraham's seed, and the spreading of the gospel throughout the world is the means by which the Abrahamic promises are being fulfilled. God is blessing all nations through Abraham's seed, Christ. Through the gospel, in other words. So that from Abraham on, through the Old Testament and through the New Testament, and even up to our present time, all history since Genesis 12 has been the fulfillment of the promises made in Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3. So it could be said that Genesis 12, 1 through 3 is the center point of God's Old Testament history. And interestingly enough, it is the chronological center point too, because Abraham lived essentially exactly 2,000 years before Christ, and therefore 2,000 years after Adam. So if the whole Old Testament period is seen as 4,000 years, which is reasonable, it's divided exactly in the middle by Abraham at the 2,000 year point either direction. 2,000 years after Adam, 2,000 years before Christ, which is an interesting coincidence. What's amazing, though, is that the first 2,000 years, the first half of that, is all encompassed in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. 11 chapters of Genesis encompass the first 2,000 years. The rest of the Old Testament, the other 2,000 years. So you can see the comparative importance of Abraham, the post-Abrahamic history. Many books of the Bible are devoted to that history, but we have only a sparse history of the first 2,000 years before that. Only a few very important events are recorded in that first 2,000 years. Now, let's take that first part, the pre-Abrahamic history. Pre-Abrahamic history, Genesis 1 through 11, the first 2,000 years after Adam. We don't know much about it, but there were several major events in it. Of course, the creation, and then the fall, apparently shortly after creation. Then we have the story of Cain and Abel. And then we have a genealogy in chapter 5 of Genesis, and then we come to the time of the flood. From the time of Adam to the time of Noah and the flood, there are 10 generations. They're long ones because people lived approximately 900 years per person before the flood. At least the ones recorded did. So the whole period from Adam to the flood, which is probably about 2300 B.C., that period is in 10 generations. From the flood to the time of Abraham is also 10 generations, shorter ones. The people lived about 500 years after the flood rather than 900. But for some reason, that 10 generations is a shorter period. It's a longer period. It's 2,300 years. The flood was apparently about 1,700 years after Adam, roughly, 1650 or something like that. 1656? Thank you. 1656 years after Adam was the flood. And so a little more than 2,300 years from the flood to Christ. And so we have the Tower of Babel as the final recorded event after the flood and before Abraham. So that's how the first 2,000 years are documented. Just a few things. Creation, fall, Cain and Abel, the flood, Tower of Babel. And that's what the first 11 chapters of Genesis cover. Now, After Abraham, of course, we have a lot of history. Abraham's call is in Genesis 12. He had eight sons, Ishmael and Isaac being the first two, Ishmael by a slave girl, Isaac by the free woman, Sarah, and then there were six additional sons by a woman named Keturah later on. Of those, Isaac is the only one that really commands center stage after his birth. Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau. And then Jacob had 12 sons and one daughter that are recorded. The 12 sons of Jacob became, of course, each had a family, and these families got large and became clans or tribes. Jacob, in his lifetime, had his name changed to Israel. He had a night where he wrestled all night with a divine visitor. And that divine visitor changed his name from Jacob to Israel. And afterwards, he was sometimes called Jacob, sometimes called Israel. The two names are interchangeable, sort of like Simon and Peter, or Levi and Matthew. These were two names borne by one individual. And so, after this wrestling match with this divine messenger, Jacob was also sometimes called Israel. His 12 sons, then, were sometimes called the children of Israel. And likewise, the generations that came from his 12 sons, the 12 tribes, were the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. Those terms probably sound familiar if you've read the Old Testament. Well, these children of Israel, in the days of one of them, Joseph, in order to escape a famine, went down into Egypt. You've read about that in the book of Genesis. They end up getting stuck there for a while. And a Pharaoh who was not favorable toward them put them into slavery. And a very severe slavery, apparently. So that they were very much afflicted. And God raised up Moses after they had been in slavery for hundreds of years. And Moses was the deliverer. So in Exodus, God raised up Moses and delivered the people from Egypt. Right in the middle of Exodus, Exodus has 40 chapters. In the 20th chapter, God brings them to Mount Sinai and makes a covenant with them, which includes the Ten Commandments and many other laws that God gave them. The covenant was this, that if they would be faithful to God and His covenant, then they would be a nation. They had been before that just a big family, just a bunch of people who were descended from one line of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The 12 sons of Jacob, or sons of Israel, had become very large clans by this time. And there were probably millions of them, if you include women and children. We know that when they came out of Egypt, there were like 600,000 men of the children of Israel. So it had really grown while they were in Egypt, from 70 souls going in to 600 and something thousand coming out. And yet, even when there were 600,000 of them, they still were just a big family until they came to Mount Sinai. At Mount Sinai, it was the birth of the nation. God brought these people out of Egypt to Mount Sinai, and He established a covenant where He made them a holy nation to be His people, His nation. This was, of course, a fulfillment of promises that He had made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob earlier. But now, hundreds of years later, He is establishing this covenant at Mount Sinai with their descendants who have now escaped from slavery in Egypt. After He made that covenant, He set out to lead them to the promised land. This promised land was the land that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had lived in, and where the 12 sons of Jacob had been born. But they had been in Egypt for a long time. So it was time to go back to the promised land and take that land for their own. However, because of their failure of faith, they angered God, because they did not believe that God could deliver the land to them from the inhabitants who were already in it, although God had promised that He would. And so they provoked God to anger by not believing that He could deliver the land to them. And so He said, okay, then I won't. Not you. I'll give it to your children. You will wander around in the wilderness for 40 years until you're all dead, and then your children, I'll give them the land. And so that happened. That's what the books of Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy cover. That 40 years that the Israelites wandered in the wilderness prior to going into the promised land. This takes us right up to the death of Moses at the final chapter of Deuteronomy. And Moses died just before the time that the Israelites went in to conquer the land. Moses appointed, at God's direction, a successor to himself, and that was Joshua. And Joshua was to be the commander of the children of Israel to take them into the promised land. So the book of Deuteronomy closes with Moses' death, and the next book, Joshua, begins with the commission God gave to Joshua to lead the children of Israel faithfully to conquer the land. Joshua became a general more than anything else. Moses had been a prophet, a lawgiver, a national leader in general. But Joshua primarily had military functions, even in the lifetime of Moses. In the first battle the Israelites fought after they came out of Egypt, the Amalekites attacked them, and Joshua went out and led the armies, while Moses and two men went up on the hills with their hands up, Aaron and Hur, with Moses' hands up anyway. And so Joshua took over the lead of the armies of Israel at the beginning of the book of Joshua, and the book of Joshua has about 24 chapters, I believe. The first half, the first 12, describe the 25 years or so it took them to conquer all of the land of Canaan. The latter half has to do with administrative matters, especially the division of land to the different tribes. And then Joshua dies. After Joshua died, there was no successor to Joshua. Moses had appointed Joshua as a successor, but there was no successor to Joshua. Instead, there was a period of time which lasted over 400 years where Israel had no established leadership except tangentially or occasionally. The people of Israel during the time of the Judges, and that's where the book of Judges and the book of Ruth take place during that time, about 400 years or more than 400 years. From the Exodus to the end of the period of Judges is 480 years. So you have to subtract the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness and the approximately 25 years of conquering land. So it was approximately 400 years they had Judges, it would appear. And during the period of the Judges, the Bible says twice in the book of Judges, there was no king in Israel and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now every preacher I've ever heard use that text says that's a bad thing. But actually, it's not a bad thing. That's what God set up. God did not intend for Israel to have a king. Rather, he left it so that everyone could do what was right in their own eyes, with the assumption that having been given the law, they would do, generally speaking, the right thing. And they didn't always. They often went off from obeying the law and worshipped gods that were pagan gods. And God would judge them by bringing a pagan nation in to conquer them and bring them under tribute and under bondage for a brief period of time. When Israel would come under bondage from invaders during the period of the Judges, after a while they'd cry out to God for mercy and he would raise up a deliverer, and that deliverer would be what we call a judge. And there were a number of these, I think about 12 if I'm not mistaken, are named. So there were actually 12 tribes of Israel. I believe there's 12 judges. There's 12 minor prophets. There's 12 apostles. 12 is a significant number in the Bible. But I believe there are 12 named judges in the book of Judges. And some of them may have overlapped chronologically in different parts of the country because some of their captors may have only conquered the northern or the southern part of the country. But in any case, these judges would rise up and God would anoint them to lead the armies of Israel against their invaders and deliver them. Israel didn't have any standing armies during that time. In some cases, they didn't even have weapons because some of that time they were under the Philistines who wouldn't let them have weapons. They didn't let them have ironsmiths or metalsmiths at all, lest they should make weapons. And whenever they had to sharpen their farming tools, they had to go to the Philistine smiths to have them sharpened because they weren't allowed to have weapons of their own. But even though Israel had no standing armies, no central government for 400 years, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes, God, when he raised up these judges, they were able to blow the trumpet and gather the individuals who were willing to come, and they'd fight these wars, and God would give them victory, and they'd be delivered. Samson was one of those judges, although he's kind of unusual in that he didn't ever marshal armies. He just did it single-handedly. But most of the judges had armies of Israel following them. But see, after they would free their people, the judge would kind of stay, in most cases, he'd just kind of stay in office, we could call it. There was no official office, but people, because he would deliver them, they kind of looked at him as their leader, sort of like George Washington heading up the American troops, kind of as the natural guy to be made the leader of the country initially. And so people respect the general who delivered them, and so the judge would stay kind of in a position of leadership of sorts, but would not be a king. He would judge the people. That's why they were called judges. And judging meant they would arbitrate like at a court of law, like a magistrate. If people had disputes, they'd come to the judge and they would use the law of God to say, well, this is how you should settle that. But the judges did not become kings. And they did not start dynasties. And when they died, their sons didn't like step into their office. Nor was there an election to replace them. When the judge died, there was a vacuum again until the next crisis. And then God would raise them up. So during the 400 years of the judges, Israel was led, as apparently God wanted them to be, by individual charismatic leaders that God would raise up ad hoc, you know, for the purpose of, you know, solving some crisis. The rest of the time, the people just kind of minded their own business, farmed their land, were unmolested by government or taxes or anything like that. And that's apparently how God wanted it, because God was their king. That's the point. When he brought them to Mount Sinai, he said, I'll be your king. And so they didn't need another king. Everyone answered to God. That's also, I think, how God set up the church initially. Paul said, the head of every man is Christ. And I believe that the institutionalization of the church at a later date, long after the apostles' time, I think was probably a mistake, just as it was a mistake to institutionalize the leadership of Israel. This happened at the end of the period of the judges. The last of the judges was Samuel the prophet. And when he was old, the people of Israel came and said, we're tired of having this power vacuum. You're old. You're not going to be with us that much longer. Your sons are unfit to take your position. So give us a king to rule over us, like all the nations have. And Samuel was displeased by this, and he went to God about it, and God was displeased too, but he said, go ahead and give them what they want. They haven't rejected you. They've rejected me, that I shall not reign over them. This is in 1 Samuel chapter 8, so we've gotten beyond the judges and Ruth. Ruth was during the period of the judges. A story of a family. It happens to be the family David came from, which makes it a significant story. But in Samuel, we have the last of the judges leaving his position as judge in chapter 8 and appointing a king, the first king of Israel. Now, it was not a good thing that they appointed a king. God was angry that they wanted a king. He had been satisfied with the period of the judges, where God was their king. But now they were rejecting that. They wanted to have central government. And God told Samuel, you warned the people, if they get a central government, they're going to pay taxes, 10%, which was considered oppressive. How much do you pay? And they'd have standing armies. And he said, your king's going to take your sons and daughters and draft them into the military and to be confectioners and servants in his household. In other words, it'll be an oppressive thing to have a centralized government and armies and so forth. And they wanted it anyway, so they set up the kingdom under a man named Saul. Saul turned out bad. He rebelled against God. And so God appointed a different king, David. Now, Saul was of the tribe of Benjamin. David was of the tribe of Judah. And David became king by stages. He was anointed king in a private ceremony in his father's house, but was not recognized as king by the nation until much later, after Saul died. When Saul died, the nation eventually made David king. First, his own tribe of Judah made him king for 7 years. 7 and a half, I think it was. And then after that, the rest of the tribes decided to make him king too. And he reigned for 40 years. After his death, his son, Solomon, reigned for 40 years also. Interestingly, Saul, the first king, had reigned for 40 years. David reigned for 40 years, and Solomon, his son, reigned for 40 years. And that wasn't an artificial term. They died at the end of 40 years of reign. I'll tell you, if I was Solomon's son taking the throne, and I'd gotten to be the 39th year of my reign, I'd be getting nervous. But the other kings didn't die after 40-year reigns. Actually, interestingly, in the period of the judges, we're told that each of the judges, after they were victorious over the enemies, they judged Israel for 40 years, each of them, except for a few of them who did it for 80, which is obviously just double that. So 40 is an important number in the Bible, and either some people think that the historians are just rounding it off, or even using the number 40 to just say a generation without specifying the exact number. Yet, assuming those numbers are precise, God sovereignly apparently allowed that each ruler, at least among the first rulers, would rule for 40 years, and that'd be the end of it. And then Saul, David, and Solomon were the only kings who ruled over all 12 tribes. Because after Solomon's day, the nation divided and never reunited, and they would have two different kings at a time because they'd be two different nations. Solomon, unfortunately, fell away from God. And a prophet came to him and said that God was going to take 10 of the tribes away from his kingdom. And there was a rebellion in the time of Solomon's son, Rehoboam. This is going to be at the beginning of the books of Kings, or in the midst of the books of Kings. Solomon died, his son Rehoboam became the king. And when Rehoboam was king, he made some really foolish administrative choices, especially about taxation, and there was a rebellion, a sort of a Boston Tea Party, only it was really, he lost almost the whole kingdom. 10 of the 12 tribes, the ones to the north, just disattached from David's dynasty, and set up their own king, Jeroboam. And Rehoboam still reigned over the two southern tribes, Judah, which is the big one, and Benjamin, which is a very small one. And so the southern kingdom under David's dynasty was called Judah, because Judah was like a lot bigger than Benjamin. It was two tribes, but Benjamin was an insignificant little tribe attached to them. The southern kingdom, therefore, under David's line of kings, was called Judah. The northern kingdom, because it contained 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel, was simply called Israel. And sometimes it was called Ephraim, because Ephraim was the largest of those tribes in the north, and so sometimes the northern kingdom is called Ephraim. But you've got, from the time of Solomon's son Rehoboam on, the kingdom's divided. And the northern kingdom, I forget exactly how long it had its own sovereignty, I think maybe about 120 years if I'm not mistaken, something in that neighborhood. And they had 19 kings in the northern kingdom. Every one of them was bad. They never had a good king. One or two of them seemed like he might be semi-decent at the beginning, but they went bad real quick. All of the kings of the northern kingdom, Israel, were evil. And so God sent the Assyrians, who conquered and destroyed that kingdom in the north, in the year 722 B.C., 722 years before Christ, that happened. And the northern kingdom came to an end. And the people of Israel were dispersed among the nations. Eventually they intermarried with Gentiles, and that's where the Samaritans came from. The Samaritans were the products, eventually, of the marriages between those northern kingdom tribes of Israel and Gentiles. And so they were considered, the Jews considered them half-breeds. The Jews, on the other hand, were named after the tribe of Judah, which was the southern kingdom. The southern kingdom had 20 kings, most of them bad. A handful of them were good. There were kings like Josiah and Asa and Uzziah and Hezekiah, who were good kings. But most of the kings of Judah were just as bad as the ones in the north. Now, when Assyria conquered the northern kingdom of Israel, at a later date, Assyria came down to Judah to try to conquer Judah also. So that both the kingdoms were threatened by Assyria. The northern kingdom was destroyed by Assyria, but when Assyria came down to the southern kingdom, they succeeded in doing a lot of damage to the villages of Judah, but they besieged Jerusalem, the capital, and were not able to conquer it. They probably would have been able to, but God intervened. Hezekiah was the king in Judah in those days, and he was a good king, one of the few that they ever had there. And when the Assyrians besieged Jerusalem, the capital of Judah, King Hezekiah was getting counsel from a variety of court counselors. A lot of them were telling him he should send messengers down to Egypt and try to enlist the help of the Egyptians to come and fight against the Assyrians and help him out there. But the prophet Isaiah was present in Jerusalem in those days, and he counseled King Hezekiah. He said, God doesn't want you to seek help from Egypt. He wants you to seek help just from the Lord. And so Hezekiah listened to prophet Isaiah and sought help from the Lord. He received, Hezekiah received a threatening letter from the Rabshakeh, the general of the Assyrians outside Jerusalem, sent a letter into the king Hezekiah and told him to surrender. And Hezekiah took that letter into the temple in Jerusalem, and he laid it out before the Lord and asked God to deliver them. And that night, as the Assyrians slept, an angel of the Lord went out into the Assyrian camp and killed 185,000 Assyrians. So in the morning, when the survivors awoke, they saw that their ranks had been totally, depleted, and they freaked out and they left. They didn't stay. So Jerusalem was delivered. So the northern kingdom was destroyed by the Assyrians. The southern kingdom was threatened, but managed to survive because God intervened, and because there happened to be a good king who was looking to God in those days in Judah. However, there were bad kings after him, and sadly, even Hezekiah, the good king, his son was the worst of them all. His son Manasseh actually led Judah into terrible idolatry, and because of what Manasseh did, the prophets said that God was going to lead Judah into captivity in Babylon. Actually, the prediction that the Babylonians would come and plunder Judah was made even in Hezekiah's own lifetime. One of the last stories we have about Hezekiah is how he recovered from an illness, and some Babylonian emissaries came to visit him and congratulate him for his survival. Apparently it was a life-threatening illness. And while they were there, Hezekiah showed the Babylonian guests all of the treasures of Jerusalem. And after they were gone, Isaiah the prophet came to Hezekiah and said, "What did you show these men?" And Hezekiah said, "I showed them all of our wealth and all of our treasures." And Isaiah said, "Well, the day will come in the days of your children, your descendants, that the Babylonians will come and take all this away." And of course, that was fulfilled considerably later, at least 50 years after Hezekiah, I suppose. And there were several kings after Hezekiah, essentially bad kings. Josiah was a good one, but the rest of them were bad. And so in 586 BC, the Babylonians came and destroyed Jerusalem and carried the Jews in captivity. The Babylonians had attacked a couple of times earlier. They had come and invaded Judah in 605 BC, and at that time they had taken some captives, including Daniel and his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so these men had gone into Babylon as captives in 605 BC. About 8 years later, in 597 BC, the Babylonians came back and took some more captives to Babylon. That included Ezekiel, the prophet. He went into captivity in 597 with the second wave of captives. But the final wave was in 586 BC, 13 years later still. And that was when the Jews did something very stupid. The Babylonians had subjugated Judah and Jerusalem and had set up a governor of their own to be the sort of the vassal under Babylon to rule in Jerusalem. And some fools in Jerusalem assassinated that governor. And, of course, that brought the wrath of Babylon down on. And the Babylonians came down, destroyed Jerusalem, burned down the temple, slaughtered Jews and carried the rest into Babylon. So in these three waves, the Jews end up going into Babylon, 605, 597, and 586 BC. It was in the latter date that the temple was destroyed. And the Jews spent time in Babylon. 70 years is what the prophet said it would be. And it was 70 years by certain reckonings. There's more than one way to reckon it. You can start with the 605 date or the 597 date or the 586 date, and measure forward 70 years, and you come to different dates, of course. But at later dates, there were exiles that did return, three different dates. And the first of those was in 539 or 538 B.C. The Babylonians were conquered by the Persian Empire, by Cyrus, the leader of the Persians. And Cyrus, when he conquered Babylon, gave a decree that all the subjugated peoples that Babylon had taken away from their homes, all the people who had been brought in to get Babylon as captives, the Jews and the other nations too, that had been brought, were given permission to go back to their ancestral homes. In the case of the Jews, they were given permission to go back and rebuild their temple in Jerusalem. This had been predicted. Isaiah had predicted that Cyrus would do this. And Jeremiah had predicted the end of the exile too. And so the Jews were given permission to go back to Jerusalem from the Babylonian exile, but only a small number of them did. I believe the first number that went back was 50,000 of them, still a very small percentage of the Jewish population in the Babylonian kingdom. They followed a man named Zerubbabel, who was their governor. He was descended from the kings of David's line, but he never was a king. He was just a governor. And the Persians authorized him to take people back and to start building the temple again. So Zerubbabel led about 50,000 captives back into Jerusalem, the remnant. Among them were two prophets, Zechariah and Haggai, who encouraged them because they were small in number. They didn't have a big budget for building the temple. When they started building the temple again, it was obvious it was going to be inferior to Solomon's temple. Solomon had built a temple that was like, he spared no expense. When Solomon came to power after David died, David left the kingdom of Israel as wealthy as it ever would ever be. The very wealthiest period of Israel's history was when David reigned. So Solomon inherited immense wealth from his father, but he squandered most of it. A lot of it he spent on the temple and on his own palace, but he also squandered a lot of it on other luxuries. And when Solomon left power, Israel was impoverished. Now, Zerubbabel and his generation rebuilt the temple in Jerusalem, but it was a somewhat inferior temple. And after that, there were a couple of other groups of Jews that came back from Babylon. One group came back under Ezra, and one group came back under Nehemiah. Ezra was a scribe and a religious leader. Nehemiah was a governor, a later governor than Zerubbabel. And these men were godly men who helped the remnants who had come back to Jerusalem reestablish their original religious roots and things like that. Now, after that time, we have the prophet Malachi, the last of the prophets in the Old Testament, prophesying that the people of Judah had really become slack in their religious devotion. They were neglecting to pay their tithes to the Levites. They were neglecting to bring the best of their animals for sacrifices. They were bringing lame and blind animals as sacrifices, which is actually forbidden in the law. They were disappointed because they thought that when they would come back from Babylon, God would pour out his blessing. You see, many prophets before the exile had predicted that God would take them into exile and bring them back and pour out his spirit on them, and there would be great wealth and great rejoicing and a wonderful time. But what they didn't understand was that these prophecies would be fulfilled when the Messiah would come. And when the Jews came back from Babylon, the Messiah didn't come for another, over 500 years. And so in Malachi's day, about 400 years before Christ, the Jews had become discouraged. The expected prosperity, the expected revival didn't occur. And so they had gotten apathetic in their religion. So Malachi the prophet rose up and rebuked them for that and called them back to good behavior. We don't know how they responded to him because we don't have any historical records in the Old Testament that date after Malachi's time. But there was extensive history, of course, after Malachi's time and before the time of Christ. There is the intertestamental period after Malachi, from 400 BC till the coming of Christ. There was a lot of stuff going on. For one thing, during that time, Alexander the Great conquered the Persian Empire. Alexander was a Greek, Macedonian, and he conquered the Persian Empire, and so the Grecian Empire replaced the Persian Empire, which had earlier replaced the Babylonian Empire. So the Babylonians had conquered the region, then they were conquered by the Persians, then they were conquered by Alexander in the late 4th century B.C. Realize that's the small 300s, like 325, 330. That's that range B.C. that Alexander was conquering that area. Alexander was a young man, I think 18 or 20 when he started to lead the armies of the Macedonians. He conquered the known world of his day in 12 years. But before he was in his mid-30s, he had conquered the world, became the most powerful man in the world, became bored, and drank himself to death. And there was no more worlds to conquer. Some say he died of syphilis, and that may be true also, but some say he just drank himself to death because he was bored and complained there were no more worlds to conquer. But when Alexander died, and this is in the intertestamental period because this happened after Malachi's time. Malachi was 400 B.C., Alexander was closer to 300 B.C. So we're getting almost a century closer to the time of Christ when we have Alexander. When Alexander died, his kingdom was divided up among four of his generals. A couple of them are not important to the biblical story, but two of them are. Because one of them took over the portion of Alexander's empire that was north of Israel, predominantly Syria, to the north of Israel. And his name was Seleucus, that general. And another one of his generals, named Ptolemy, received Egypt to the south of Israel. Now, actually, Seleucus originally was one of Ptolemy's generals, and he went up and conquered, took over, assumed the leadership, of, I should say, of Syria. But to just kind of summarize this, it gets very complex. In the period about 300 years before Christ, Israel was flanked to the north and the south by the Seleucid dynasty under Seleucus and his descendants to the north in Syria, and the Ptolemaic dynasty, the Ptolemies, spelled with a silent P at the beginning, P-T, Ptolemy, P-T-O-L-E-M-Y, Ptolemy. The Ptolemaic dynasty in the south in Egypt and the Seleucid dynasty in the north in Syria. And initially, Palestine or Israel belonged to the south. When Alexander's kingdom was divided up, Israel was under Egypt's rule, the Ptolemies, for about 100 years, till about 200 BC, roughly. And so it was okay. It was okay for Israel under the Ptolemies. The Egyptian rulers, you know, treated them with a measure of respect. But the Seleucid rulers at a later date, and by the way, all the Ptolemies were called Ptolemy 1, Ptolemy 2, Ptolemy 3, Ptolemy 4, and so forth, on up to 6 and 7 and so forth. But the Seleucid dynasty, the names of the successive rulers were Seleucus the First, Antiochus the First, Seleucus the Second, Antiochus the Second, and so forth. So they were alternately Seleucus or Antiochus. And the city of Antioch in Syria was named after Antiochus. But the point is that in a later generation, one of the Seleucid rulers in Syria, Antiochus the Fourth, he tried to conquer Egypt. He tried to conquer the Ptolemies. And now, here's the problem. There were wars between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, and Israel was right between them. So Israel was disputed territory. It was also territory that the armies would march through, invading each other, you know, going from Syria to Egypt or vice versa, you have to go through Israel. And so during that period of time, Israel was often trampled on by armies that didn't have a particular interest in them, but in getting through their territory, but they'd also rape their women and plunder their houses and stuff. So the Jews suffered a lot during these wars. But one particular northern king, Antiochus the Fourth, who called himself Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphanes means the illustrious one. He called himself Antiochus the illustrious one. Now his enemies called him a similar sounding name, Antiochus Epimenes. he called himself Epiphanes. They called him Epimenes, which means the madman. But he called himself Antiochus the Illustrious One. He was Antiochus the Fourth. And he tried to conquer Egypt, but failed. One reason he failed is that when he got down to Egypt, he was not very far from Alexandria, which he probably could have conquered. But the Romans, who were a rising power at that time, the Romans had not done any of their great conquests yet of the region, but the Romans were a powerful, growing force at the time. They didn't want Antiochus to conquer Egypt because that would make him too powerful there in the east. And so the Romans sent a fleet of ships to intercept Antiochus in Egypt. And as he was near to Alexandria and could have probably conquered it, this Roman fleet came and confronted him. And the commander of the Roman fleet drew a circle in the sand around where Antiochus was standing and said, "Do not leave this circle until you command your troops to retreat." And Antiochus himself, at an earlier time in his life, had been a hostage in Rome. It's a long story how that happened. But because his father had a bunch of war debts they owed to Rome, and it's a hard thing to say, but Antiochus had spent an earlier time in his life as a youth in Rome as a hostage, and he had seen the power of Rome. Although Rome had not really expanded yet, he knew the power of Rome, and he was afraid of them. And so when the Roman fleet told him to go home and leave Egypt alone, he did so, but he was humiliated, and he was angry, and as he marched through Israel, he just took out his rage on the people, on the Jews. Among other things, he sacrificed a pig, an unclean animal, in the temple of the Jews. This is called by Daniel the Abomination of Desolation when he did this. This is in 168 BC. And he also outlawed Judaism. He enforced Hellenistic or Greek culture on the Jews. He forbade them to circumcise their children. He made it a crime punishable by death to own a copy of the Jewish scriptures, or to keep the Sabbath, or to observe any religious holidays of the Jews. Well, this was a crisis, obviously, for the Jews, because God required them to circumcise their children to keep Sabbath. So here we have this oppressor, this Adolf Hitler type of a guy, really, who's, or maybe more like a Saddam Hussein type guy, who's telling them they can't keep their religion, but God says they have to. And so there arose in Israel at that time, a group of devout Jews who died as martyrs, essentially, because they would not stop keeping Sabbath or stop circumcising. They were called the Hasidim. 150 years later, the Pharisees were the ones, the group that developed out of these Hasidim. They were the devout resistance movement against the Hellenistic culture in the days of Antiochus Epiphanes. The Hasidim, where they were devout Jews, they were good people, eventually developed in the Pharisees, which obviously, like most religious movements, after generations become somewhat legalistic and corrupt in some ways. But that's where the Pharisees arose from during this time. Now, one thing that happened during this time that's very remarkable is that a Syrian official from Antiochus Epiphanes came down to a Jewish village called Modin. Spelled M-O-D-E-I-N. Modin. And he gathered the village people around, and this Syrian official set up an altar to a pagan god. And he commanded the priest to offer a sacrifice on this altar in a public ceremony to the pagan god. Well, the priest refused. And another citizen of the village just walked over and said, "I'll do it." And so he was going to do it. And the priest took his sword and killed the Jew who was going to do that, because under the law of Moses, any Jew who worshipped idols should be put to death. And then the priest killed the Syrian official. Now, they knew that that would be a provocative act in the eyes of the Syrians. And so this priest and his four or five sons fled into the mountains and started a resistance movement, and other sympathetic Jews joined them in large numbers, and they had a guerrilla band that would run raids on the Syrian soldiers. This is called the Maccabean Revolt. It's called the Maccabean Revolt because one of the sons of this priest, the priest's name is Mattathias, but one of his sons was named Judas, whose nickname was Maccabeus. The word Maccabeus means the hammer. No one knows why he was nicknamed the hammer, probably because of the crushing blows he dealt against the Syrians. Some say his head was the shape of a hammer, and that's why they called that. I don't know, like a hammerhead shark, I guess. But he was, that's honestly one of the suggestions made, but he was, for whatever reason, nicknamed the hammer, which is Maccabeus. And so the revolt was called the Maccabean Revolt. And Mattathias the priest was killed. Each of his sons in succession were eventually killed. Some very heroic battles. They're recorded in the book of 1 Maccabees, which, although it's in the apocryphal literature of the Old Testament, it's considered by almost all historians to be historically accurate. Josephus also tells these stories. And, you know, like one of the sons of the priest died by breaking, there was like a Syrian official, might have even been Antiochus, come to think of it. I don't remember. He was riding an elephant through the streets, and this Maccabean brother, he ran through the ranks, and he got under the elephant, and he stabbed the elephant with a spear and killed the elephant. And the elephant fell on him, so he died. But I think the official also died falling off the elephant or something like that. But there's some interesting battle stories in 1 Maccabees about these wars. This war lasted about 3 years or a little less, and amazingly, this guerrilla band of Jews who lived in the mountains and ran raids on the regular troops of Syrians, they won. They drove the Syrians out, and they rededicated the temple, which had been, after Antiochus had sacrificed a pig in there, the temple was considered defiled, and the Jews didn't use it anymore. But after the Maccabean Revolt was successful, they won their independence. And that's the first time the Jews had independence from pagans since the Babylonian exile. They'd gone into Babylon in 586 B.C., and they'd been under the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, the Egyptians, the Syrians. And now, in, you know, like 165 B.C., suddenly they are a free people again, briefly, for about 100 years till the Romans came along and conquered them. But they celebrated the rededication of the temple with a ceremony called the Festival of Lights, which is celebrated every year by Jews, called Hanukkah, around Christmas time. And so that's that bit of history. After that, there was a period of time before the Romans conquered the region where the Jews had their own independent state, but it was corrupt. The priests initially were called the Hasmoneans. They ruled initially, then eventually there were intrigues, there were assassinations and things like that. Different people took power from other people. And finally the Romans came in and about 70 B.C. kind of conquered the region. And they conquered Jerusalem, I believe it was in 40 B.C., they conquered Jerusalem. And they set up their own ruler in Jerusalem to replace the Hasmonean dynasty that the Jews had been, following. But the ruler they set up was Herod the Great. And he's the one who was there when Jesus was born. And he was a ruthless tyrant. When Herod died, his sons divided up his power. Actually, the emperor Tiberius divided up what had been Herod's realm among his three sons. And one of those was Herod Antipas, who in Jesus' day ruled in Galilee and was the one who put John the Baptist to death. Another one was Herod Archelaus, who ruled in Judea after Herod's death, but he was such a mismanager that the Caesar removed him from power in 6 A.D. So he was only there for about 10 years. And then after that, governors or procurators were set up to rule in Judah, of which Pontius Pilate was, I believe Pontius Pilate was the 5th of those procurators. Later on, Agrippa in Paul's day, and Felix. Actually, Agrippa was a king, but Felix and Festus were procurators of Judah in later days. So these are some of the names you read about in the New Testament. But you see, there was that period in the Old Testament covered 4,000 years, right up until the time of Herod, and that's when Jesus was born. Now, we need to take a break, but let me just give you a real quick summary of New Testament history. The first 30 years of New Testament history is fairly silent. We've got birth stories about Jesus in Matthew chapters 1 and 2, and also in Luke chapters 1 and 2. Those tell us about Jesus' birth, and they tell us almost nothing about his childhood. A few infant stories, and then one brief story about Jesus when he was 12. After that, nothing more is said about those first 30 years until chapter 3 of Matthew and chapter 3 of Luke. And Jesus began his ministry after John the Baptist began his. And Jesus' ministry was approximately 3.5 years in all likelihood. I say in all likelihood because no one knows the exact length, and there are different theories. One theory is it was 2.5 years. We know there are three Passovers in Jesus' ministry. There's one that's mentioned early in Jesus' ministry in John chapter 2. After Jesus probably had only been in the ministry for a few months, there was a Passover in John chapter 2. Then there was another one when he fed the 5,000. We're told that's at Passover time in John 6. And then there was another Passover when Jesus died. Jesus died at Passover. So there are three known Passovers. And the first of them was a few months after Jesus began his ministry. So if there's a few months and then one Passover, then another Passover is like a year and some months, then the Passover Jesus died would be 2 years and some months. So why do we say his ministry is 3.5 years instead of 2.5? There is a feast in John 5 that is not named. We don't know if it's a Passover or not. Most scholars seem to believe it was a Passover feast. It's not clear. If it was, then we have 4 Passovers in the ministry of Jesus, and that extends it to 3.5 years. The common view is that Jesus' ministry is 3.5 years, of which we can divide them up roughly into 3 segments. The first could be called the year of obscurity, because there's very little that Jesus did in public during that first year. He was baptized. He went away to be tempted in the wilderness for 6 weeks. He had some conversations with the woman at the well, with Nicodemus, and turned water into wine at a family wedding and so forth. But there was really not much public going on in Jesus' life during almost the first year of his ministry. That's the year of obscurity. Then there is a year we could call the year of popularity. Probably a little more than a year, but roughly a year. Between those two Passovers. The Passover where Jesus, in John chapter 2, drove the money changers out of the temple. That was kind of his public appearance. And then there was the next Passover is when he fed the 5,000 and then he gave the bread of life discourse and most of the people fled from him and didn't want to follow him anymore. And so then began the year of opposition. And that led up to, of course, the passion and the crucifixion and the resurrection of Christ. When you come to the book of Acts, there's approximately 30 years covered there. The crucifixion of Jesus was probably in the year 30 A.D. There are two theories. Some say it was 33 A.D. We won't get into that right now, another time. But Jesus was probably crucified in the year 30 A.D. The book of Acts takes us up till about 60, maybe 62 A.D. And I'm not going to surveil that history because we've run out of time. But the book of Acts really covers all that history. First, the 12 apostles are evangelizing in Jerusalem. Eventually, because of persecution, when the first martyr, Stephen, is killed, they spread out and they evangelize in Gentile lands. Saul calls him to go to the Gentiles, and so the Gentile mission begins. And most of the latter part of the book of Acts is about Saul's journeys. The book of Acts ends with Paul, under house arrest, really waiting for trial before the Roman court. And that's how the history ends of the Bible. So, 4,000 years of history in the Old Testament, about 60 years of history in the New Testament. I mentioned the Old Testament was 4,000 years and divided right in the middle by Abraham. I didn't mention this, but I might, but that second 2,000 years from Abraham to Christ is divided right in the middle by David. David was 1,000 years after Abraham and 1,000 years before Christ. So it's kind of interesting how these key changes happen. The establishment of the covenant with Abraham at 2,000 years from Adam, the establishment of the Davidic covenant with David 1,000 years later, and then Christ 1,000 years after that. And that's just, I mean, that doesn't seem to be anything that was in any sense artificially calculated, you know. I mean, the Jews who wrote the Old Testament didn't know about Jesus or believe in him, so they didn't calculate how long it would be from Adam to Christ. It was just worked out that way. Sounds kind of providential, though, just because of the symmetry of all that. All right, we'll stop there, and we'll have an introduction to the Pentateuch after this next break.